Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you taking a little time out of your day to join me as we continue going year by year and set by set through the big old monster box that was once collecting dust, but it's always been collecting cards. Some brands people like, others, meh, not so much. But this one, this set I always liked, even if the value of the cards is, well, negligible these days. That's often the case when you're looking at cards from 1992. We're looking at 1992 Fleer, a big step forward for Fleer, certainly after the debacle that was the 1991 set. But like everybody else, catching up with Upper Deck in terms of quality and design, and also some young stars, including our random pull. This would be a rookie card from the 92 Fleer set, card number 49, Mo Vaughn. Yes, big Mo Vaughn, terrorizing the American League throughout the 1990s, terrorizing his teammates and random people, the general public, with his attitude, and terrorizing any restaurant or bar serving food after 10 o'clock at night. Yes, Mo Vaughn, when you said put your weight into it, he did, and he would often clobber the ball, mashing it like a turkey grinder on a Tuesday morning. So we'll talk about Mo Vaughn and his interesting on-the-field, off-the-field antics, but also, I should say, in all honesty, positive post-career career, if you will, post-baseball career. He's done some very good things over the last few years, and it kind of balances out some of the hijinks and hilarity that he exhibited as a player back, you know, in the 1990s and early 2000s. First, let's talk about what you're talking about. And there's a lot being talked about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. As always, I encourage you to share our podcast with your friends, whether they collect now or collected once upon a time. We come to you every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom and iTunes. And we also encourage you to pass the word on the Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains as we talk about our podcast. We talk about the players that are featured there. And we also talk about just the hobby in general. We've got a lot of great conversations going on. And a lot of the conversation, not surprisingly, over the past few days, has centered around our previous podcast, which was on 92 Donruss. And of course, 92 Donruss was a much better product, first of all, because they had to be with the competition. Again, 1992 was the year that everybody took a giant leap forward in the race to try to keep up with Upper Deck in terms of quality and also just popularity. But certainly with Donruss, after those train wreck sets that they released in 1990, and a better, slightly improved train wreck, you know, the wheels just came off the tracks a little bit in 1991. 92 Donruss was a much sharper, more businesslike, very appealing card set. Although I'm more of the, yeah, it's nice, but I was never totally impressed by it. And by your response, I'm actually kind of surprised how some people saw this set. This is now, I believe, one of those sets that falls into the, you either love it or you don't. There's really no middle ground with 92 Donruss. And we'll start with Horror Movie Barbecue. That is such a great Twitter handle. Give yourself a pat on the back there. Writes, oh, the Donruss 1992 set, that was a fun set that me and my buds went crazy over. Also, Chris Starr, awesome Greg Maddux pick. And we just used a Maddux picture. I'll be honest, I lifted off of Google Images. We used a Greg Maddux picture just to promote the podcast. But yeah, great action shot of him with the Chicago Cubs, of course. Jim Tumbleson, the 92 traded update is one of the rarest sets, tough to come by. Yeah, I didn't mention the update set for Donruss in 92, but as opposed to everything else that was made in 1992, that actually was a limited edition, and given some of the young stars that were coming up through the big leagues then, the few quality rookie cards that you could pull out of that, there is still some value to it, like I said, as opposed to everything else where there are 4 or 5 million copies of it. David Armour, this set is still one of my favorites. And let's see, Beans Ball Card Blog. I remember how much of a shock it was when I saw these packs of and cards. Donruss was always my favorite set of the year as a kid. And yeah, it was a shock because, and I mentioned this in the podcast, even when you saw the wrappers, there was this, you know, first of all, it was the foil wrapper. It was their first time getting away from wax. But also you have these kind of regal, you know, royal blue and royal kind of, you know, red or a crimson color with the wrappers. It's like, oh, well, they're trying to take it up a notch here. And they did. So while there were a lot of people that liked the set, there were a few, like myself, who didn't like it. And I don't hate it. It's just one of those sets where I go, eh, okay, they're nice, but you can have it. Philip Hubert, not so much. Greatest ugly set of 1992. I wouldn't call it ugly. That's you, Philip. But yeah, you know, it certainly didn't grab my attention. Certainly all these years later, it hasn't. Tim Murray, on my comment about the backs of the cards, I mentioned that there was a lot of information on the back of the card. And with Donruss utilizing the bleed-in effect of the player picture that was just slapped right in the middle of the back of the card, it made it really busy. And Tim makes a great point. I recall player photos on reverse often bled into stats line, rendering numbers indecipherable. There is your triple word score for your next Scrabble game. And that is something that does happen, Tim. In fact, if you look at our random poll, which was Juan Gonzalez, you could see, especially against the dark blue Rangers jersey that he was wearing, you could have numbers bleed into letters very, very easily. In fact, it was also brought up by our friend Baseball Card Backs. Agree with you to a point about 92 Donruss backs. I think more is more, and other than limited stats, there's a lot to like here. Now, again, I like the back of the card. I like what Donruss did because this was a huge, huge change from what they had done on the backs of their cards, really, in the history of the company. But certainly, ever since 1985, that's kind of the template that they used from 85 to 91 with very few changes, just change of color. And even the 82 to 84 sets were very similar to the 85 through 91 stretch. So overall, I liked the backs to the 92 Donruss cards. I just thought there was a lot of stuff crammed into the back of the card. And Baseball Card Back shares a picture with us of card number 203, which was Sandy Alomar Jr. And to Tim Murray's point, if you look at the top, now you can read these numbers, but Alomar wearing the dark blue Indians batting practice jersey, and had they used a different picture, some of those letters and numbers may be indecipherable. And that's the last time I'm going to say that word, as I'm bound to trip up all over it. But still, you know, some mixed reviews on the back of the cards. But overall, I like the back of the cards because Donruss not only just put a picture on the back, which every card company was doing by 1992, but they made it kind of blend in there. They put it kind of in the middle. And even though Juan Gonzalez, as I mentioned in the podcast, had the "who farted on my leather couch" look on his face, it was still a very unique placement, just kind of floating there in the middle. It's just with all of the information on the back, it was a very, very busy back to the card. Now, we also have a commentary from, N. Diunti. I can only hope I somewhere got close to properly pronouncing your name. Your Twitter handle is Examine Baseball. I got that. He brings up this great point. That set was buoyed by the Frank Thomas Diamond King insert card. It was going for $20+ at the time. And I mentioned there that 1992 was the first year Donruss made the Diamond King an insert card and not just part of the base run. So there was added value to the entire set, as all of a sudden, instead of just being one of 800 cards or just under 800 cards being produced by Donruss, now it had insert qualities. So it was, I want to say it was like two or three to every hobby box is what the going rate was. Might be four to every box. But still, you had 27 cards and they were spread out. And of course, with Donruss upping the ante in terms of quality, you now have the always beautiful Perez Steele Gallery pictures of your favorite players. Well, now they were on the thicker cardstock. They had the glossy look to them. They looked really, really nice. Not all that different from the Gallery of Stars cards that you saw in Donruss Triple Play, which was essentially Donruss Diamond Kings, just a smaller subset that was geared towards kids. And I think I still, you know, in a folder somewhere, I still have a handful of Gallery of Stars cards and Diamond King cards. I know, like, Joe Carter, who else? Felix Jose, I want to say, had a card that year. Jeff Bagwell, I've got one of those. I forget if it's Diamond King or Gallery of Stars. Frank Thomas I have as well. They're not going for $20 anymore. I did a quick search, and depending on the player, you know, Ken Griffey Jr. was another one. Depending on the player, you know, ungraded, you're looking at $2 to $5, which is, in the grand scheme of things, not much. But you look at pretty much any other card not produced by Bowman that was released in 1992, you know, those cards are like 2 to 5 cents now. So if you can pull a $2 to $5 card out of a 1992 Donruss pack, and as I mentioned in the podcast, you can get those boxes for, you know, $8 to $10, depending where you buy them, then, you know, that's a nice little return on your investment there. And finally, speaking of return on investment, Joey W. says, big sale over at Dave and Adam, a steal for one of your favorites, and he sent us a screen cap of the deal at dacardworld.com. 88 Donruss Baseball Wax Box, $5.95. I'm not even going to click on this to see if there's any kind of shipping involved here. While I like the design, Joey, if there's one thing I don't need, it's another box full of 88 Donruss cards just clogging up space in my house. But I do appreciate the sentiment. And I appreciate all of your comments. Again, at Wax and Gum Stains, join us anytime on Twitter to talk about our podcast, the sets we talk about, the players we talk about, or like Joey did, just the hobby in general. It's a lot of fun having everybody join us. And speaking of somebody joining somebody, I will be a guest on Beckett Radio, their podcast, this week. I don't know exactly when the podcast is coming out, but we're going to connect on the phone on Wednesday. So be on the lookout for that from our friends at Beckett Radio, who do an outstanding job with their podcast. Looking forward to spreading the word of Wax Ecstatic to their listeners, and hopefully, you know, being part of a very legendary name in the hobby, you know, Dr. James Beckett, the Beckett Baseball Card Guide. You know, now everything's online, and they do a really good job of having an online price guide, and, you know, you can organize your cards there. But, boy, when the Beckett Baseball Card Monthly came in the mail, that was quality time. You got that out of the mail. You know, you could have had a check for $500 in the mail, but when the Beckett Baseball Card Monthly came in, you went straight back to your room, and you looked through it. And yeah, they had some interesting articles and they had some, you know, interesting pictures, but you'd go straight to the price guide and you'd look at all the sets that you were collecting and you would look up to see which cards and which sets in general, but especially specific cards, which ones had the little triangle pointing up, because your card value was going up, baby. You had money, money in the bank. This card is not just $3, it's $4.50. Better put it in a top loader. Of course, you also had the devastating news if you saw the triangle going down. Oh, crap. That's only $2. Oh, well. So there you go. I'll be on Beckett Baseball podcast in just a little bit, so we appreciate the invite from them and their interest in what Wax Ecstatic is doing. And also, just a reminder, we are open for business in the sense of looking for a title sponsor to the show. Just looking for one sponsor, one product or service that we feel connects with our listeners real well, and our listeners will connect with you. We're not looking to overload the podcast with a bunch of advertisements. We're also not looking for a quick mismatch between both sides. We feel that there's a product or service out there that our listeners can use, and vice versa. So if you have that product or service, just direct message me and we'll try to work something out. Low price point, very small production cost in making this podcast, but we certainly have a very dedicated, growing group of listeners here, and we certainly want to connect you to them and them to you. Now, talking about making a connection, Mo Vaughn did that quite a bit in his career. And I'm actually going to talk a little bit about Mo Vaughn first, and then we'll look at the 92 Fleer set. As Mo Vaughn was a guy who went to Seton Hall, he had some great teammates, including Craig Biggio, who was the random pull of our 1991 Bowman set. Also, a future Red Sox teammate, John Valentin. He was the MVP at the 1987 Big East Conference Baseball Tournament. And, of course, the Pirates winning the championship that year. So you could tell at a very early age that Mo Vaughn was destined for stardom. Drafted in the first round, 23rd overall by the Red Sox in 1989, he signed with them and very quickly made his way up through the system, becoming, dare I say, a star player in 1991 as he appeared in 74 games, putting his mark on the American League early with a .260 batting average, 4 home run, and 32 RBI. Again, those 74 games with 251 plate appearances. And he would start getting more and more time in the big leagues, basically becoming a full-time player in 1993, a key cog in the rebuilding of the Boston Red Sox. Gone were the days of the Sox teams that you saw, certainly in 1986 and the one that got pummeled by the A's in the 1990 ALCS. In 93, Vaughn would hit .297, 29 home runs, 101 RBI, in 152 games. And then he started his reign of terror on American League pitchers in 1995 as the Red Sox were, thanks to the new wild card system, were able to cruise into the playoffs. And it was a big reason why. It was because of Mo Vaughn, who, despite 140 games, having to deal with some injuries, still hit .300, had 126 RBI, led the American League in that category, and 39 home runs. He also had 150 strikeouts, which also led the American League. Sometimes you get that with the big-time sluggers. A silver slugger that year, the first of 3 All-Star appearances in his career, and he was the American League MVP that season. And he continued to just be an absolute force at the plate in the mid-1990s, batting .326 with 44 home runs in 1996, another All-Star season, finished 5th in the MVP voting. 1997, batted .315, 35 home runs in 141 games. And in 1998, as some of the pieces are really starting to come together for the Red Sox, Nomar Garciaparra starting to rise through their system as well. 30-year-old Mo Vaughn in 154 games, 40 home runs, .337 batting average, another All-Star season, 4th in the MVP voting. So everything's looking pretty rosy in Boston. No. Off-the-field issues, including a temper. He was a bit of a loose cannon. And, of course, the Red Sox back then, a little stodgy. There's still this kind of image that they would uphold. Not quite the Yankee legend image. But, you know, the Red Sox, they were pretty much from that same era. They didn't like his antics. They were afraid that he was going to taint some of the younger players that were coming up, some of the core pieces of the club. So when he became a free agent after the 1998 season, the Red Sox didn't exactly trip over their feet to try to keep him there. They basically just said, all right, good luck. It's been fun. Have fun storming the castle. Goodbye. And he would sign what was then a monster deal, a 6-year, $80 million deal with the Anaheim Angels. It was the most lucrative deal in baseball at the time. That's right, for about $12.5 million a year, Mo Vaughn was getting paid the most money in Anaheim. And at first, it looked like a pretty good deal. First season, 139 games, hits 33 home runs, bats .281, and, the Angels are still kind of building up a little bit here. In 2000, he appears in 161 games. That matches his career high with the 1996 season. Bats .272, still hits 36 home runs, strikes out a whopping 181 times. So he's still hanging in there. And I remember watching the Angels at a game at Tropicana Field, and it would have been in 2000. He and I think it was Garrett Anderson and somebody else in the lineup, I can't remember, they hit back-to-back-to-back home runs. Of course, the Devil Rays pitching back then was pretty atrocious. But, this guy, even though the Angels were not a very good team, this guy could crush the ball 100 miles. So you're thinking, okay, well, once the Angels start getting the rest of the band together and pull it all together, well, over the course of this contract, surely they're going to be a good enough team and he's going to lead the way. Well, he was plagued by injuries, to put it nicely. In fact, he didn't play a single game in 2001, and he was rubbing the Angels brass the wrong way, and teammates as well. Troy Percival very famously blasting Vaughn on the way out as he got traded to the New York Mets. And then Vaughn, of course, blasting the Angels back, saying that, well, they don't have any, you know, World Series flags hanging in their stadium. Oops, the Angels would win the World Series in 2002 in 7 games over the San Francisco Giants. Meanwhile, in 2002, Mo Vaughn, at the age of 34, is playing in New York with the Mets, and the Mets just desperately trying to hang on to that decent playoff run that they had in 2000, trying to keep their group together. And Mo Vaughn was just trying to keep it together, appearing in just 139 games, still striking out 145 times. bigger issue, though, his batting average plummets to 259. His home run production plummets to 26. And the only thing that didn't plummet for Mo Vaughn by that time was his waistline. He was coming in, I believe, at like 265 pounds. If you look at the back of this card, card number 49, he was listed at 225 pounds. So here's a guy who, you know, if that listing is right, then he was putting on 40 pounds between the seasons. And if you remember watching Mo Vaughn play, it wasn't necessarily all muscle, although there was some of that with the aid of some needles. We'll get to that in just a little bit. But, you know, here's a guy who put on a good 40, 45 pounds over 6 or 7 years. And, of course, when you're in New York, you're in the media spotlight to begin with. But then, when you're not performing well and the team is paying you a lot of money, and then the team is not playing well, well, the media and the fans in New York, they just turn on you like a bunch of rabid dogs. And Mo Vaughn was basically laughed out of, you know, New York. He would play in the 2003 season, however, having a career-ending knee injury. So the numbers on his 2003 season, definitely nothing worthy of writing home for. Appearing in just 27 games, hitting 3 home runs, and having a rather humiliating batting average of 190. So his career ends prematurely, only 12 seasons in the big leagues, 293 batting average, 328 home runs, 1,064 RBI. Not Hall of Fame worthy, but again, this was a guy who absolutely dominated the American League for the most part throughout the 1990s, and his attitude got him in trouble, his weight got him in trouble, but also eventually steroids would get him in trouble, as he was named in the Mitchell Report. And really the biggest mistake that Mo Vaughn made was he left behind a paper trail, a notable paper trail, with 3 personal checks that he gave to Kurt Radomski, who delivered drugs to Vaughn. Well, Radomski kept copies of the checks, so that pretty much did in Vaughn. And if his numbers weren't going to get him into the Hall of Fame, certainly this mountain of evidence behind it didn't help his cause in any stretch of the imagination. Now, while Vaughn, was a big power hitter in the 1990s and a big failure near the end of his career in the early 2000s, I am very happy to say, just doing a little research on him, he's been able to turn his life around a little bit and also help turn around the lives of others. He's a managing director of Omni New York LLC. They've bought and rehabilitated, looks like up to just under 1,200 units of distressed housing in the New York metropolitan area. And it's not just, you know, individual houses, but also apartment buildings and stuff like that. And he's also, according to reports, not only fixing up housing, but trying to make them safe communities. It's, anti-gun, anti-drug, you know, trying to keep people who do live there on the up and up. So not necessarily public housing, but just trying to create a better environment with better housing. He's also the president of a trucking company called Mo Vaughn Transport. And in case you didn't know, he is the nephew of Greg Vaughn, who was our random poll in the 1990 Leaf podcast. So the Vaughn family is still very active in baseball, even after Greg and Mo have finished playing, as Vaughn's son, Corey Vaughn, and I mentioned this in the podcast for 1990 Leaf, has been involved in professional baseball for the last few years. So even though Mo Vaughn's career ended with a whimper and ended up being the butt of jokes, especially because of his ballooning weight and not necessarily because of the injuries or the suspected drug use that he had, very good news to see that after his playing career, you know, he became a person who helped rehabilitate neighborhoods in New York, also in the Boston area, and still has some ties to the Boston area. So even though he left on a sour note, he is still kind of keeping tabs with everybody there, although I'm not exactly sure the Red Sox have welcomed him back with open arms. But I would have to say, you know, Mo Vaughn was, and it's funny too, with how things have worked out, because Mo Vaughn in many ways was what David Ortiz is to the Red Sox now. But with Vaughn's exit, that kind of opened the door for Ortiz to leave the Twins and come to Boston. It's kind of funny how things have turned out. So Vaughn, a bit of a loose cannon as a player, able to turn things around rather nicely, not only for himself, but also for hundreds of others in the New York and Boston area. Now, speaking of turnaround, the 1992 Fleer set was a major turnaround compared to the mess that was created in 1991. 91 Fleer, as we discussed in that podcast, by the thoughts of many collectors, the worst set in baseball card history. Now, I still put 82 Fleer at the top of the heap, but 91 Fleer is, if not number two, definitely number three. So the 91 Fleer set was an unmitigated disaster. People did not like the yellow look. People did not like the cheaper card stock, and Fleer was still putting their cards in wax packs while everybody else was starting to progress to tamper-proof packaging. And also, they were moving on to better card stock, better photography, a little more limited edition with certain inserts. Well, Fleer finally did that in 1992 when they created a set that certainly did far better than the 91 set just in general design. And if you look at the random pull here, Mo Vaughn's number 49 card, and that's actually one of the big changes that they made. 1992 was the first year that Fleer didn't order the cards by how a team finished. That's how they used to do it prior to the 92 set. So, for example, in 1991, the 91 Fleer set, the Cincinnati Reds were the first team because they won the World Series that year. And then it went from first to worst, I should say. Well, in 1992, they did it by teams, alphabetical order. So the Baltimore Orioles were the first team. The Boston Red Sox were the second team. And they still listed the cards or still ordered the cards in alphabetical order based on the player's last name. So Mo Vaughn, one of the last Boston Red Sox cards in that little team set, as Fleer was just trying to simplify things. And that's how I like their look here. It is a very simple look. First of all, a much better card stock, a little bit of a shine to the card stock. In fact, you look at the picture that I took, there's a little light in the background that's kind of shining down on the lower right-hand side of the card. That was not part of the design, just a little bit of a flash there. But I've always liked this kind of emerald green look that they had to it, which in true Fleer fashion, and we saw this even going back to 1987, they did this nice little gradient from the dark color to a lighter green to white. They did the exact same thing in 87, except utilizing blue as opposed to green. And also there's a personal connection here. I think this shade of green reminds me of a color of a car that my dad once had. We bought a used, 1979 Mercury LTD. Boy, that thing was a battleship. It wasn't battleship gray. No, it was 92 Fleer green. So some weird quirky connection to that color for me. But 92 Fleer had a very nice, classy, business-like look. And that's something that I always liked about the 1980s Fleer sets, in particular 83 through 87. And if you listen back to our podcast from those years, you know, we came up with these nice, trendy business names. So I'm not exactly sure after, you know, a few disaster sets or, you know, the 90 Fleer set I liked but called it a classic baseball look. 92 Fleer, what would you call this? No, well past the yuppie stage. Preppy, maybe? I was in high school then. We didn't like preppies, although I love the preppy look here. So this is your Beverly Hills 90210 set from Fleer coming out in 1992. Great photography, a lot of action shots for Fleer that year. Also, the team logo in the upper right-hand corner, the player name, the first name was listed horizontally underneath the logo. The last name was vertically, which presented some very interesting challenges if you had somebody with a last name like Van Landingham, seeing how they crammed it in there. Also, the player names were listed in a team color. So, for example, the Orioles had orange lettering, the Red Sox had red lettering, the Blue Jays had blue lettering, the Mets had orange. So, you know, there was some consistency there. Player position in the lower right-hand corner, Fleer logo in the lower left. Let's flip the card over. The basic 1992 Fleer back was just like 1991, except executed a lot better. First of all, the color photograph on the back, which Fleer bragged about in 1991, even though others were doing it well before them, taking up almost the entire top half of the picture, also opposed to 91, where it was just a circle of the picture, taking up, quite a bit of the real estate up there, along with the card number in the upper right-hand corner in a baseball diamond or base shape, which is kind of cool. You've got the player's name, personal information in a little strip right down the middle, and then in the bottom half, you have what was very traditional of Fleer, and that was, of course, the vertical stripe pattern with alternating colors, going with the green and white look this year, but also the complete professional stats of a player. No interesting graphics or cartoons or charts like they had from 87 through 90. They abandoned that in 91. I kind of wish that they had that, because that was a pretty unique way of breaking down stats. But again, with everybody trying to catch up to Upper Deck, well, Upper Deck didn't have anything cool like that, so Fleer wasn't going to go out of their way to do that. Overall, I like the Fleer set from 1992, much like every other set, though, from 1992. Do not expect to make a mint off of these. Don't expect to get any big dollar cards. You know, you do have, young stars like a Ken Griffey Jr. You know, maybe you can sell that card for a dollar. If you get it ungraded and you just try to make some quick change off of some of the cards. Also, like a lot of the 1992 sets, there were millions of these cards produced, so there's really no scarcity in it. The art cards, one of the few saving graces of the 91 Fleer set, present in 1992. And I remember some, like Frank Thomas, where the art card is him. It's a horizontal card, and he's holding a bat, and inside the bat is like a bomb, which was kind of neat. Terrifying nowadays, but kind of neat back then. Cal Ripken Jr. had one as well, one of several players who had the art card, so I remember those extremely well. Those were pretty nice. And also in 92 Fleer, they had a couple of insert cards that were certainly not to the status of what Upper Deck was inserting, but you have the Roger Clemens tribute cards, if you will, these very nice black border, gold foil career highlights. And the funny thing is, Clemens' career was pretty good up until 1992. Of course, he would play another, 13, 14 years, which is pretty amazing when you look at it. But also they had their all-star cards, and Fleer had always put in these all-star cards that were part of the base run. Well, much like Donruss reverted the Diamond King to a insert card, that's what Fleer did. They made their all-star cards, which looked just like the Roger Clemens cards with the black border and the gold foil. They made them inserts, and there was actually some value to those. And I would imagine today they probably still have some value if you can find, a Tony Gwynn all-star card or a Cal Ripken Jr. or a Ken Griffey Jr. You know, those cards might be worth a dollar, and same thing with the Roger Clemens cards as well. You can get boxes, much like every other 92 set, anywhere $10 to $15 for a wax box. I've seen complete sets for, around $20 plus or minus a few bucks. So this is one of those sets where 92 Donruss, I just went, it's okay, but you can have it. 92 Fleer, this is one where, again, you go to your hobby shop or you go on eBay or wherever and you see, somebody selling two boxes for $15 shipping included. Hey, you got a little disposable income, got a little time, want to go ripping through some packs. There are far worse sets to do that with than 92 Fleer. If you didn't collect 92 Fleer back then, or maybe you're too young to remember that product coming out, or you're one of those people who go, oh, that's junk wax, I don't touch it. This is one of those sets that is actually very, very nice. I had a lot of 92 Fleer cards. They were part of the mass card exodus out of my house. I kept a stack of them, the good players and the rookie cards. But that was one of my favorite sets to collect back then. And I won't say I wish I didn't get rid of them. It's not like a couple other sets that I got rid of stacks and stacks of them and kind of wish I hung on to them. But this is one, if you collect it, there's no harm in doing it. It's just like scratching off lottery tickets. You may spend $15 on lottery tickets and get zero. You may spend $15 on a couple boxes of 92 Fleer and at least get, a few collectibles that you can just put into plastic pages. What you do with the rest of them, totally up to you. But it's a nice set. Looks nice. A big, big upgrade from what they did, certainly in 1991. But if you look at the sets that Fleer produced from 88 to 91, with the exception of 1990, I was never a big fan of any of those sets there, so this was a big step up for them. And I remember 25 years ago, this was one of the sets that I spent a lot of time and a lot of money acquiring. Tops was big for me that year. I started collecting Upper Deck a lot more, but Fleer was one of those sets where I just bought pack after pack, and I do recall buying a box or two back then. Had a lot of fun going through those cards. Well, I had a lot of fun talking to you about that 92 Fleer card number 49, Big Mo Vaughn, our Italian dressing mainlining home run hitter, is our random pull. And we're going to take Fleer an extension on Friday when we take a look at Fleer Ultra. 91 Fleer Ultra was just kind of this lazy attempt to produce a premium card. 92 Fleer Ultra was a very, very good product, certainly up at the level of Stadium Club. And for Fleer to make that giant leap with that premium card, they really took a big step forward in that and really set the trend for the Fleer Ultra brand for many, many years, not just in baseball, but also other sports that Fleer made cards for. I remember buying hockey cards in 92 and 93. The Fleer Ultra sets were very popular. I always liked those, and I especially liked the baseball set that they put out in 1992. So we'll do a random pull from the 92 Fleer Ultra set. We'll talk about that set and whatever you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We're coming your way via Audio Boom and iTunes on Friday. We'll talk to you then.